we haven't. Because you're not justified in part or in whole by law. And even more scary, and what makes, you know, there are lots of Christians today that will accept that, maybe with some mental reservations, but will accept that. But when you start talking about we're not sanctified, we're not kept saved by law in part or in whole, then the hair on the back of our neck starts standing up. Because how else in the world am I going to know? I mean, this law gives me something concrete to measure it by. And it did the Pharisees. And they picked out the things out of the law that they chose to use as a measurement, the standard of whether or not they were saved. And it's really interesting what they picked out. What's the number one thing they picked out? The observance of the Sabbath. That's the number one thing that they picked out. Why would you suppose? Well, because you can measure that. Are they at church? Are they there on Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night? You can measure that. And were those things, was the observance of the Sabbath important? Boy, if you don't believe it was, go back in the Old Testament and see what the Lord said to those people who went for years and years without observing the Sabbath. He was really, really upset at them, and he punished them for not doing it, didn't he? So it wasn't that it's not important. It's our Colossians 2 passage again. It said if you pick those external things to measure your spirituality, and that's what determines your spirituality, how good you are and how well you keep laws, then that doesn't touch the heart. And even in the Old Testament, God said, the day's coming when I'm going to make a covenant with the house of Israel. And he's going to, by the way, interestingly, in Romans, he's going to address who true Israel is. I'm going to make a covenant, but I'm going to write it on their hearts. It's not going to be written on stone. And the righteousness is going to come from inside. It's not just going to be surface laws and rules. And so now in Romans chapter 1, we picked up last week in verse 18, God's wrath is going to be revealed from heaven against certain people. And we hold that concept all the way, actually, till 3:20. But specifically through this context of chapter 1, there are certain people who God's going to reveal his wrath on. And let's not forget that as we go through, because until you get to 3:21, he's not talking about grace. The words are not in there. From 1:18 to 3:20, he's not talking about mercy. He's not talking about salvation. He's talking about how and why a person is lost. Now, the overarching thing would be, if you want to try to be justified by law, you need to know what you're facing. God's wrath is being revealed from heaven against all godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth. And we talked about what that truth was. Our mind automatically goes to the gospel. But he's not talking about the gospel here. Because this truth that he's talking about here, he says, the next verse, since what may be known about God is plain to them because God made it plain to them. And he did so, in verse 20, through the creation of things. Now, what truth did God reveal through the creation of things? What can you know by looking at the sun and moon and stars and grass and your body and so forth? What can you know? What truth can you know? Somewhere there is a supreme being who's much, much more than man is, right? You can know that. You can know that with certainty. I mean, we don't even know how many galaxies and solar systems there are out there. We're still discovering. And so man didn't do that. It was someone who's much, much more powerful than man is. And God said his people, not only in the consequence of what we're talking about right here is, and somebody talked to me about it after class, and they said it exactly last week. God not only holds you accountable for the truth that you acknowledge, God holds you accountable for the truth that he makes available to you. That's important. Because there are people who choose to ignore it. And they don't want to know this. Because they feel like, well, if I admit that this is true, then I'm going to be, that's going to be a standard of my judgment. That's going to be incorporated in my judgment. But if I just ignore it, then it's not going to be. Meh. Wrong. If God made it available to you, he's going to hold you accountable for how you handle the truth that was made available to you. And see, in 1:18 through 3:20, we're not talking about people who had a Bible. We're just talking about the Gentiles. We're just talking about what relationship they had to God from the knowledge that they could know through nature. And don't say that I said that a person can be saved by observing nature. I haven't said that. The only way that you can know a personal God who loved you and sent his son to die in your place is by direct revelation from God. Written revelation. The Bible. But you can know some things about God from nature. He says his eternal power and divine nature. He expressly says in this context here. You can know that God is divine. You can know that God's something much, much more than a man by that. And then whenever Paul will have his address on Mars Hill later, he will say God did these things in creation so that man would feel after him and find him, though he be not far from any of us. He designed the world and created the world in such a way that when man looks at it, it creates this wonder. It creates this desire to know this being who could create something like this. And we're blessed here at Woodland Oaks. It's a blessing and cursing that we look out the window here and we can see some really beautiful nature here. It's a curse that there are squirrels that jump around while I'm preaching because there are people who watch them, you know. But we see God's nature. And it's a wonderment, isn't it? And don't lose that. Instill it in your children. I mean, take the time, you know, when you see a grasshopper, take time to stop and pick it up and talk to your kid about it. Just things. And teach them about God. Because it reminds us. We get up here on some plane that we're just totally divorced from nature. And you're not a richer person for doing that. You're a poorer person for doing that. I mean, how many of you noticed the moon the last few nights? Boy, that thing's beautiful, isn't it? I mean, it came up early and stayed up, you know, and boy, just beautiful, isn't it? Yeah, I understand that people that work in the nursery and in the hospital notice when the moon's full, too, so. She was saying the school teachers know when the moon's full. They know when kids have had lots of sweets from Halloween, too, don't they? But God's wrath is being revealed against people who have this information that God himself made available to them, and they suppress it by their wickedness. And then we pick up, and we started talking about a sequential departure that man makes from God. And it's really incredible that you can see it. You can see it in our nation. You can see it in other nations. You can see it in individuals. You can see it in societies. And it all starts the same place, and it goes through this sequence of steps. It doesn't skip any of them. It happens this way when man departs from God. Righteousness exalts a nation. And you can see when unrighteousness is at work. And when it's been at work for some period of time, then we are this many steps from God, however many that is. There's about five steps that we have here that man departs from God. And it all starts, the first step away from God and suppressing this truth that God has made known to us, the first step is thanklessness. Refusal to thank and acknowledge God for what you have. And that's where we ended last time. We talked about that. We really, really need to teach our children to be thankful. It's not an ego trip that you want your child to say thank you when you've done something for them. It is for their good. And they need to consistently say that. And you're not doing them any favor whenever it's too much trouble for you to remind them to say it, and so you just skip it. Don't skip it. They need to acknowledge. What when you say thank you to someone, what in essence, what's behind that? What are you saying? What are you acknowledging? A what? Gratitude. And? That's right. And you're acknowledging a debt, aren't you? Have you ever thought about that? When you say thank you, you're acknowledging that that person has done something for you, and underlying that in some sense. Now, hopefully they didn't do it for that purpose, but underlying that is, I owe you something. And I really believe that's important, because I believe that is an insight into why lots of folks won't say thank you. Because if I don't say it, I don't owe you. And I think that that can become, you've heard me say before, and I don't mean to be picking on anybody, because I talk to them about it whenever I'm over there and used to make lots of trips to Russia. I perceive that to be characteristic of Russians. They won't acknowledge, they won't say thank you for something. And probably if you were to trace back their government and so forth, it plays a role in here. But to say thank you to somebody acknowledges an indebtedness to that person. And so we need to say to God, and I hope you were reminded some this week, and you'll make that more and more practice of your life, that when something good happens in your life, you'll say thank you. And then one day our faith will grow to the point that even when a difficulty comes into our life, we'll be able to say to the Lord, thank you. I want to get there, don't you? I want to get there. And you can get there more when you look back in retrospect in your life and see that there were things, there were circumstances that happened that you thought were just catastrophic and horrible, and no good thing could possibly come from it in your life. And you can look back in retrospect and see that God used that for your benefit or for your family or something. And then it becomes easier as you put those things together and have those experiences. But God's wrath is being revealed from heaven against these people. And in the process of departing, the first step is thanklessness in first part of verse 21. Although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him. So that's step number one. Step number two is in verse 21, the second part of it. He says, but their thinking became futile and their foolish heart was darkened. And although they claimed to be wise, they became fools. The second step, and it always builds, and the first one has to take place first. The next step that's going to take place is we elevate our reasoning above God's revelation. We think more of what we think than what God says. And we choose our reasoning and what makes sense to us over what God has said. If he says build an ark out here in the middle of the desert, we look at the situation and say, I don't think so. How in the world could that possibly do anything for anybody out here in this sand? And we decide, okay, on this side are the reasons why I should build this boat, and on this side are the reasons why I should not. Now, which one do you think is going to be the longest? The should not side, isn't it? I mean, there. If we started listing reasons why you should not, if you started listing reasons why you should take your son and sacrifice him on an altar, and then the reasons why you should not, which list is going to be the longest? So we need to know that up front. There's going to be a lot more human evidence, a lot more human reasoning, and what we would say is common sense, that's going to go on this side than it is on this side to do what God tells you to do. It's always going to be that way. It's always going to be that way. And when you begin to choose consistently the one that makes a sense to you and you discount what God says, then you're taking one more step away from God. And he says, their thinking became futile. The word futile means void of result. It's a dead end. And we could illustrate that. Their foolish hearts were darkened. And although they claimed to be wise, they became, and you know what that word is, fools. The Greek word for it is M-O-R-O-S, is the anglicized way of saying the Greek word, moros. How many guesses do you need as to what English word we get from that? Professing themselves to be wise, they became morons. Boy, God looks at things differently than we do, doesn't he? And so we really get ourselves well educated, and I'm not against education. I'm really, really not. But human education has a tendency generally to lead us to rely on ourselves, doesn't it? And so he says, and the second step is we elevate our reasoning above God's revelation. And then the next step from that is, verse 23, he says, and exchange the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. And then skip down to verse 25. They exchange the truth of God. Here we are back to that truth again. That truth that men suppressed. They exchange the truth of God for a lie. And worship and serve created things rather than the Creator, who is blessed to be praised forever. Amen. So the next step, we're thankless. We refuse to acknowledge that God is the one who gave us everything that we have. We elevate our knowledge above God and our reasoning above God, and we choose what we think rather than what God said. And the next step is, see, we've elevated ourselves. We're bringing ourselves up, and what are we going to do to God? We're going to bring him down. And ultimately, we're not going to stop with bringing God down to our level. You know what we're going to do? We're going to become God. We're going to bring God down lower than us. We are. Now, we got some really fine, nice, acceptable ways of saying that. But we are. It's what the problem was in the garden. What was the appeal to Eve about partaking, eating that fruit? You will be what? As wise as God is. That sounds pretty good. I get to be the captain of my own ship. I get to be the one to call the shots. And so in this case, when you've elevated your reasoning above God's, the next thing is you bring God down. And you worship and serve created things. And even gave some examples here. And by the way, if you're a biologist, you really do like these. I have them written in my old Bible here, but animals is the word for the Greek word is quadruped. And we get many, if not most, of our classifications in science from the Greek language. And so there, he says he exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. Have there been societies that worship men as God? Certainly there have. Have there been societies that have worshiped animals as deity? Are there still some? Been to India lately? Are there societies that have worshipped even bugs? How about the sacred beetle of Egypt? The cow in India. Now, here's how we've come a long way, baby. Okay, here's how far we've come. We've come to the point now that we can kick over a rotten log and our God crawls out from under it. Now we've come a long ways, haven't we? We got God down where he belongs, and we got ourselves where we belong. We're the ones in control. Now, you think any of that, worshiping and serving created things? How about jobs and houses and cars and salaries and money and bank accounts and stocks? And you know, you reckon there's any of that going on? Now, you can't help yourself in this process, I can tell you this. You can see where countries are. You tell me. You tell yourself where we are as a country. Have we been thankless to God? Have we tried to give credit for what God has done to other people or take it for ourselves? Have we elevated our reasoning above God's? Have we worshiped and served things that are created more than God, the Creator, who is blessed forever? So, we're somewhere in this sequence of departing from God, aren't we? And then the next step, and it always happens this way. You don't skip any steps. It always goes this way. One of them leads to the other. You have to have one under your belt to get your courage up for the next one. Guess where the next one is? Verse 24, picking it up. Therefore, and this is the first time this phrase is used, it'll be used two more times, God gave them over to the sinful desires of their hearts, to sexual impurity, for the degrading of their bodies with one another. Pick up in verse 26. Because of this, God gave them over to shameful lust. Even their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, the men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed indecent acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty for their perverseness. Anybody want to take a flying guess about what in the world he's talking about here? Homosexuality and lesbianism. You're getting pretty far away from God, folks, when that becomes acceptable in a society. Isn't it interesting that it's in the text? And people say, God created me this way. What did he say about this here? It was perverse and it was unnatural. If it's unnatural, that means what? That's not the way God created. And it is really degrading to the way that God created men and women. And we're in step number four, unbridled immorality. That's what we're about today. And all of this thing about abortion is about, I want to do anything I want to do with anyone, anytime, sexually, and have no consequences. That's what it's all about. We're all about stopping the consequences. We're not about stopping the sin. And you know, you have a young lady who's concerned about getting pregnant. And so demand the right to do this and do this and do this. Well, you know, there is one way that you can be pretty well assured of not getting pregnant. If consequences are your thing, and you really, you know, that's your biggest concern, there's one way that's pretty sure. There's something you can stop, and you don't have to worry about it. It doesn't have to be a concern of yours, does it? And so, God gave them over to this. Have you ever had somebody, let me start that in a different way. One of the most powerful things that you'll ever have to influence your children, parents, is your approval. I don't know that there's anything. I mean, dangling a new car in front of them or threatening them with not sending them to college or whatever is not as powerful as your approval. And everybody has that. You don't have to have money to have that. God created children to need their parents' approval. Sometime when we're in a series of lessons on parenting, we'll talk about this some more, but it's real. I'll try not to stay here too long, but one of the things that's really interesting is there are some parents who can't give their approval. They're just too messed up inside. And the child who keeps trying to get that approval from a parent who will not and cannot give that approval has some real struggles in life. And if all you ever hear from your parents is being put down in condemnation, then it builds up anger inside of you. And that anger is going to come out whenever you get strong enough to do it, or old enough, or far enough away, you know, out of reach from that parent to do that, then it's going to come out. And it's, you know, it's kind of like when you're bird hunting, and some of you can't relate to this, but if you have this really, really stubborn male pointer dog, and they tend to be real stubborn, you put a shock collar on them. And so you've tried to train them with a whistle, and when they blow that whistle, they're supposed to stop and turn around and look at you, and you tell them which way to go. But they get this mind of their own, and they decide they're going to do what they want to do. And so you put a shock collar on them, and when you blow that whistle and they don't stop, you hit that shock collar, and you got his attention immediately, and he stops. And he turns around and looks at you. And it's a pretty helpful aid to do that. Getting somebody's attention, getting somebody's approval more specifically, is really important. And you know what? Age doesn't change that. It does some, okay? Because we learn to deal with things that we can't control as we get older. I mean, we all got certain pieces of our puzzle that's missing, okay? And you got different pieces of your puzzle missing than I do mine. And I learned to deal with the pieces I've got missing. But I can do it probably more effectively if I know it's missing and I recognize what's missing, and, you know, I can probably deal with that better. But if I don't know, then I just know I've got these feelings and I've got all these problems that seem to be in my life. And so I just try to just bulldoze ahead and go without it. But if you'll understand early as a parent that approval, how powerful that is to you, and you will learn how to balance that out. You can overuse it. It can become so hard to get your approval that a child will become discouraged and they'll quit trying. And you messed up. You made it too hard for them. And they'll try to get away from you. Or you can make it too easy for them. And you can approve of everything they do, and you can just slobber all over them every time they do everything and just make it be the greatest thing in the world, regardless of what they do, and feel obligated to approve of everything that they do. And you mess up that way, too, because your approval doesn't mean anything then. You can make it too hard to get. You can make it too easy to get. But with God's help, you can make a balance so that regardless of how old you are and how old they are, they still want your approval. And folks, that's a really neat thing when your kids are gone and married and away from home. And you don't want them to come running to you for every little thing, but when there's really something important in their life that they're considering doing, it's a pretty neat feeling for your child to come and sit down and say, "Dad, Mom, what do you think about this?" They want your approval. So that's an important thing. And you know what I want and what you want? I want God's approval. I really do want God's approval. And I have to tell you, when you try to get it through the avenue of law, law comes between you and God. And if you're not careful, law will become your God. We're not there yet, but I'm just throwing a little more out ahead of time, okay? And we'll come back and pick some of this up. And if you're not careful, you'll be worshiping law rather than God. And law was intended to bring you to God. But we'll stop short of it sometimes. And that becomes the ultimate goal. And we set up these little practices. But where I'm going with this is, if it's really important to me to have God's approval, how am I going to feel when God says to me, "I have tried, and I have tried, and I have encouraged you, and I have taught you, and I have given you opportunity after opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to serve me and glorify me, but you're determined to do your own thing in your own way, and you think you know better than I do, and so I tell you what, I'm giving up on you." I might have wanted to jerk a little bit of rope and cut myself a little slack, but I didn't want him to quit on me. I didn't want him to give up on me. You think it's possible that God can give up on you? He said in the Old Testament several times through the prophets, he said, Israel is like a heifer. She broke through the fences and she's gone. And I called to her and she won't come back. And even when you go seeking her and find her, you can't reason with her to come back because she likes what she's doing and she's not coming back. Well, here it says God gave them over to the sinful desires of their heart, to sexual impurity. There's a point at which God will say, okay, you insist. In spite of everything I've said and done and my pleading and my blessing, in spite of everything I've done, United States of America, or Ken Stegall, in spite of everything I've done to tell you how much I love you and how, what kind of relationship I want with you, you've insisted on doing your thing your way. Now, go do it. Have at it. God gave them up. And you know what he gave them up to? Things that the world calls fun. To the sinful desires of their hearts, to sexual impurity, for the degrading of their bodies with one another. And then he's going to elaborate on that. In verse 26, that God gave them over to shameful lusts. And then he used the example of women, exchange the natural relations for unnatural ones. Did God create them that way? No, society says it's okay. And when you hear that your whole life, from your birth all the way up, and you live in a society that says it's okay, then it feels okay. If you live in a society that says that is wrong, it's immoral, it is against God, it is against nature, then it feels wrong. But it's not the feeling that determines whether or not it's wrong, because that's determined by very much, unless God has come into your life and changed you, that's determined by what you've been taught all your life. What your teachers that you look up to taught you. The people that you respected. And some of the most educated people and some of the most influential people in our society today are saying what? I'm okay, you're okay. You do your own thing. And God made a mistake when he created me as a man, because I'm a woman inside. You might want to take that up with God. God gave them over to shameful lust. Even their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, men abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed indecent acts with other men. How plain does he have to say what he's saying? That's pretty plain, isn't it? That's plainer than I would have written it. And I kind of think that I say things pretty plainly sometimes. But that's plain. It's hard to misunderstand what he's saying here. And so as we look at this sequential departure from God, we started out with thanklessness, and then we elevated our reasoning above God's, and then we brought God down. And if there's no God that we're going to answer to, then guess what? I can do what I want to. And there's one more step. One more step. And that's in verse 28. Furthermore, since they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God. Whoa, we can stop right there. That's the next step. They said, in our departure from God, that final step is what? There is no God. They did not like to retain the knowledge of God in their conscience. There's no God. Now, why would somebody want to get rid of God? What advantage is it to me to get rid of God? The office is now vacant. And guess who's running for it? I'm running for it. If there's no God, then I'm God. I rule my own life. I determine what's right and wrong. I determine what's best for me. Now, I told you multiple times already, you can look at nations. I'm not a prophet or the son of the prophet, but God laid it out. And he laid it out in really plain terminology. You can see where nations are. You can see in some cases, and you have to be a little bit careful with this. Let's just say I can see where I am, okay? I may or may not be able to see where you are. I can see some fruit. I can't see your heart. God can, okay? So I won't say on an individual basis I can see where you are. But that's not nearly as important as me being able to see where I am. And while I may rejoice in the fact that I'm not out here at this fifth step out here, have I ever been in danger of taking that first one? Boy, I don't even want to take that first one. And if I know where this first one, where the next one and the next one, next one, if I know where that leads, even though it may not lead there in my life, my taking that step might lead, your child is going to accept where you are as the first step, aren't they? That's going to be norm to them. And so if you criticize the existence of God, or if you're somewhere along that way and you criticize that, your child's going to start there. And I can pretty well promise you they're not going to end there. But they're going to start there. And so where in all of this, where do I want to be? I want to be as close to the heart of God as I can. And so the first thing I need to do to remind myself is every moment of every day I want to be thankful to God for what he has done for me. And I want to tell him. I want to express that. And I can tell you every time I teach this, I'm reminded. Because it doesn't take very long until I get busy and I forget. I forget to thank God. And so when I'm preparing for this class, it's really beneficial to me because I get real thankful to God. And to be real honest with you, I have this week, and I've got some reason to be. I've got one daughter that's in Africa right now, and she's dealing with patients that have AIDS and TB and all kind of things. And so I got a lot to talk to God about on behalf of that daughter. And I got a son-in-law that's about to leave and go to Africa for on trips for 6 months and really primitive parts of Africa and so forth. So I got a lot to be to talk to God about, and I got a lot to be thankful for. And my daughter hopefully is going to be home this Friday, and I'm really looking forward to her getting home. And I want her to get home safe and sound. Don't you? You know what I'm saying? And so I'm really thanking God for taking care of her. And I'm thanking God for a lot of other things in my life that he's done for me. And every time I thank him, it reminds me that he's the one who did it. And that's not a simple thing. And that's where we want to get back to the heart of this thing. And we can see God's told us where this leads. And I don't want it to lead there. In my life, or your life, or my children's life, or my grandchildren's life, I don't want it to lead there. And the only way that I, only thing that I know to do to try to keep it from leading there is to get in God's Word and stay in God's Word. And listen to what he says and try to incorporate that into my life. And I don't do a great job. I'm not sitting up here telling you I do a great job at that. But I'm telling you that I try. And I'm working on it. And I want to do better. Don't you? And I know that when I look at this and I study this and I listen to what God has to say to me, that I can do better. And let's read to the end of the chapter, and I know we're out, but let's... He says, furthermore, since they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, he gave them over. That's the third time he said it. Look what he gave them over to. To depraved minds, to what ought not to be done. They have become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, depravity. They're full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. They're gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. That's a strange one to be in the middle of there, isn't it? They're senseless, faithless, heartless, ruthless, although they know God's righteous decree. Listen to this. Although they know God's righteous decree. What is God's righteous decree? That they that do such things deserve death. Did you hear that? You didn't hear that from Ken Stigall. You heard that from God. They that do such things deserve what? Death. God said that. Is it self-righteous of me? Is it judgmental of me to say that God said that? It's not. And we've got afraid to say that God said that. And we need to say God said that. Because He did. They that do such things deserve death. They not only continue to do those very things, but also approve of those who practice them. And isn't it interesting whenever you approach someone quite often and say, God said that if you do these things, you deserve death. And they say, well, what about all these other things over here? Now, why do we do that? That's exactly right. We're trying to justify what we do and make everybody else in the same boat. Well, if you're in a sinking boat, what benefit is it to you to put everybody else in that sinking boat? I want to be on one that's safe. They that do such things are worthy of death. He said they not only do those same things, but they approve of those who practice them. Surely we don't sit down in front of a TV and are entertained by this kind of junk, by people committing adultery and fornication. Surely we as Christians are not entertained by that. The lesson's yours. Thank you.